CliffCentral.com.
We've got JJ Cornish standing by. Should we try and go to him now? Let's do it. It's 6:40. I don't see why not. I'm going to speak to him about what's going on in the African continent, and we're going to look at Eritrea today, which is interesting. Eritrea is one of those little tiny countries that gets overlooked too much of the time. It's also in the Horn of Africa, or just about there, and we'll find out what their role is in everything. JJ, can you hear us? Let me see if I can bring him on here. JJ, good morning. Not there yet.
He's on mute.
Oh, is he on mute? Will you? Ah, there he is.
Mic off too. Sorry.
Oh, there he is.
Good morning to you. Bonjour.
Bonjour. How are you, JJ?
And happy Africa Day. It's Africa Day.
Yes, what a good point. Thank you for that.
Yeah, it's the anniversary of the founding of the Organization of Africa Unity in 1963, and it was kept since the founding of the African Union in 2002. But what a way to celebrate it with this, what appears to be another coup in Mali, which is a real, real trouble spot in Africa. What happened was 9 months ago, Ibrahim Boubacar Keita was overthrown, and the eventual transitional government, after some to-ing and fro-ing, involved some military people. Now, the new president, whom you mentioned, had a cabinet reshuffle and threw out two military men, and the military thought this was just too much. So they've taken him, his prime minister, they've taken the president, Banao, and they've taken the prime minister, Moktar Ouane, and the defense minister, Suleiman Doucouré, to this base just outside Bamako. You know, it really does bother those countries. I mean, we've got ECOWAS, which is the Economic Community of West African States, the West African equivalent of SADC, that is.
Right.
They're sending a delegation to visit. The United Nations, the African Union, the European Union have all expressed concern. You know, Mali, the sort of northern desert part of this kidney-shaped country, is much of it is under the sway of ISIS and Al-Qaeda, backing insurgents, you know.
Right.
I mean, they had there was a coup there that France obviously had to step in and put down some years back. Now they had this big summit in France last week, talking about trying to get the economic impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, or to assuage that to some extent. And of course, Mali would have been front and center there. Mali, much the center of the five nation Sahel group, you know, trying to fight the, Islamist insurgency in the Sahel. And so this happening in Mali is very, very unsettling for the whole of West Africa.
Well, it's really a bit of a disaster, because Mali doesn't really have a whole lot going for it, does it? And we'll talk about Eritrea in a moment, because that's an interesting country too that most people, including me, don't know a huge amount about. But Mali just seems to me to be like desert and violence and not a whole lot of other stuff.
That is absolutely true. There isn't a whole lot going for it. It's a very poor country as a result, but it's strategically placed, you know, right in the Sahel, that area between the Sahara Desert and the North African coast. You know, you were talking about the train smash in Malaysia, which is, of course, absolutely appalling. But what about the poor people of Goma in the DRC, where you have Mount Nyangongo, which is, you know, just above them, smoldering all the time, erupting. And happily, the lava flowed down and stopped just outside of Goma. I was there shortly after the 2002 eruption, which left 600 people dead. You know, Gareth, you would drive along the road and in a 4x4 vehicle. This is downtown. You didn't get in by normal vehicles.
Right.
Your vehicle would, you're driving past two-story buildings. Your vehicle would go up a sort of incline, and suddenly you'd have one-story buildings. And the fact is, you were driven on to the lava field.
Oh,
that's what would happen. It overtook parts of the, it ruined parts of the airport. I mean, the planes were landing in between the lava. I mean, and this black ash, there's just nothing you can do with it. It's just frightful, absolutely frightful. And Nyirangongo, of course, is above the Virunga National Park, the oldest national park in Africa, which houses the mountain gorillas, you know, the famous silverback gorillas. And I don't know. I've been trying desperately to find out if in any way they were affected. But the lava flow was moving towards Rwanda. And as the people fled their houses, and they now return, hundreds of homes have been buried.
This sounds like a science fiction movie where you have to drive past the lava. If you outdrive the ash, you have to try and survive. It's like a movie you'd see where, you know, this huge mountain's erupting. And obviously, because it's in the Congo, you know, we don't have like the live footage that we would if it was Mount Etna in Sicily or any of that stuff. So, the poor people of the Congo have enough to deal with. Now they have to deal with a volcano.
A volcano. Can you imagine? I've climbed to the tip of Nyirangongo and looked down into this boiling red mass below, you know. I mean, my guide assured me that everything was okay. I thought, well, I didn't hang about, you understand?
No, my God. All right. So apart from a volcano and a coup, which, you know, for us is a normal week in Africa, and to celebrate Africa Day, it would be appropriate that we have both of those things. But let's talk a little bit about Eritrea, because this is a tiny little country. It's in a promontory, a little piece of the inside of the Horn of Africa that sticks out. But what goes on there, and what do we know about Eritrea?
Well, Eritrea was, of course, an Italian colony for 52 years, and then it was liberated by the British after the Second World War, 1941, in fact, during the Second World War. And a very good friend of mine and an absolutely remarkable author, Michaela Wrong, wrote this book called I Didn't Do It For You, which she calls the sort of story of the betrayal of the small country by the West. And those words come from a British captain who, marching his victorious troops or his liberating troops through Asmara, the capital, came across this Eritrean woman who ululated her delight at being liberated.
Yeah.
And the captain looked at her and said, I didn't do it for you.
Oh, wow. That's nice. That's a great way to start your freedom.
Absolutely amazing. But nevertheless, she's written this book on this fantastic story on it. The fact is, Eritrea now, led by Azarias Averki, is one of the least liberated countries, one of the most oppressed countries in Africa, certainly one of the poorest. It has a population of 5.8 million, an area of 117.5 square kilometers. Now, its neighbors are, in fact, Sudan, Djibouti, and Ethiopia.
Mm-hmm.
So it's in a kind of tough neighborhood, you know. Sure. So anything. At the moment, they fought a 30-year war of independence from Ethiopia. And then they fought a border war, and it was Abiy Ahmed, the Ethiopian, whose Nobel Peace Prize is very largely attributed to his making peace or declaring that war with Eritrea over.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is now, ironically, Eritrean forces and Ethiopian forces are both involved in conflict in Tigray, and they haven't stopped that. And yesterday, the United States, Anthony Blinken, slapped sanctions on both of those countries. Well, of course, Abiy Ahmed is furious about it. I haven't heard what Azarias Averki has said. You know, Gareth, when you see these refugees, and we speak about them often, leaving Africa in desperation, looking for a safer and more prosperous life in Europe.
Of course.
Hundreds of thousands of them are from Eritrea. They cross the Sahara. Can you imagine how hazardous that must be? And then have to cross the Mediterranean to get to Europe. But hundreds of thousands of them are Eritreans. Azarias Averki has used the fact of the conflict to prolong national service. So me, the silverback of this conversation, I would still be liable for national service in
Eritrea.
Eritrea. Now, having done national service under the Boer regime, I'm not inclined to, I wouldn't hang around. I would probably cross the Sahara to avoid it again.
Well, I mean, this is really just such a tragic situation because, first of all, it can't be a very pleasant place to be. And second of all, it seems that the leaders of that country have zero desire to sort out the problems because they're really just in it for themselves. But hasn't Europe taken action against them? Because ultimately, they're the ones who have to bear the brunt of this immigration. And as a result of that, they have to take these people in. And in many countries along the Mediterranean, once they land there, you can't send them back. They then have an ongoing problem with trying to find these people work and trying to find these people housing. And surely countries like Italy and Spain and France and so on have to step up and tell the government of Eritrea to get their act together.
Well, yes, indeed. And they can do that as much as they like, but unless they're prepared to take more decisive action. And I think that's exactly what Michaela Wrong does in her book, talking about the country being betrayed. You know, when Italy obviously forced out, leaves a very, very strong influence. The Eritrean cycling team is the best in Africa. Hmm. You want a wonderful espresso, you go to Asmara. They serve the best espresso. You know, and it's an amazing capital. They have the Shida statue. Shida is the Arabic word for a sandal, and they've got a statue of a sandal. The sandal is what the liberation fighters wore. So they've got this massive black statue of a sandal commemorating the liberation war. There's sort of ironies about it all the time, but it really is a country that needs to have Azaria Sabaki needs to have his foot to the fire. He has used the conflict and the fact that and what makes it one of the continent's poorest, of course, for the same reason that it affected Ethiopia before, is very severe drought.
Yeah.
So it's a very, very poor country, but it's strategically placed in the Horn.
When you say decisive action, do you mean that military action needs to be brought to bear, or do you think that there is any, since we are celebrating Africa Day today, is there anything that the toothless, gormless African Union can do? Before we start celebrating Africa Day, let's actually take cognizance of the fact that the African Union has been largely unable to contain or control any of the excesses of leaders within this continent. Do you think that there's a role for the African Union to play?
There certainly is a role for the African Union to play, Felix Tshisekedi, the son, president, who is the DRC president currently, the chairman of the African Union, lists Chad, he lists Ethiopia, he lists the Blue Nile Dam problem, Mozambique, Libya as the kind of challenges facing Africa on its so-called birthday. But he doesn't even list Eritrea there, and he certainly should. You know, to have military action would be anathema in most parts of the world. Military action to force Azaria Sabaki to adopt more liberal policies. But some kind of pressure has to be brought on him. Right. You know, how did they end the apartheid regime? By using pressure.
Yeah.
And the international community has to do it. And it would be easier to do it to Eritrea. And they would certainly need to. You know, there's Eritrean journalists speaking on working for the BBC. One of them wrote that, you know, my country has been, my country now has peace, but I'm still waiting for liberation, you know, and that point is being made. Now that war with Ethiopia is over, everybody's delighted at that. The world is delighted that the shooting war has stopped, but the people of Eritrea have yet to be liberated. And that is something that certainly the African Union and the new African Unions, the successor to the Organization of African Unity, which is obliged to speak out against oppression in fellow African countries. Its predecessor, of course, was a club, you know, comfortable club of leaders who never attacked one another. The new African Union is supposed to do it, but isn't doing it enough in Ethiopia, so it should.
Yeah.
And in that case, once the African Union steps in, the international community can back it up. and coming with certainly that's what happened with South Africa, wasn't it?
Yeah.
When you had the frontline states, now SADC as it happens, but the frontline states saying this is enough, the international community could then quite justifiably step in and say this is it. You know, the thing about South Africa that was, it was bigger and more important. The United Nations, for example, can't step in unless peace and security are threatened. They can't take effective action. You know, they can have lots of general assembly resolutions.
Yeah, I'm sure that the people of Eritrea would say that their peace has not been an easy one, if there has been any peace at all for them in the last 40 years. So it's a horrible situation. I'm just pleased that you were able to inform us on Africa's birthday today, essentially, that that there is even such a place as Eritrea and what goes on there. I mean, this this leader there's, what's his name? Afwerki.
Azanias Afwerki.
He sounds like a nutcase.
Well, I think he's, I think he gives nutcases a bad name at times. Eh?
JJ, it's always good to talk to you. Thank you very much for joining us on Africa Analysis this morning. There's JJ Cornish. We'll catch up with him again in 2 weeks or so when we find out even more about this fascinating and sometimes very beleaguered continent of ours. But happy Africa Day, as he says. So there he is, brought to you by the Johannesburg Business School. Africa Analysis, and you can get that episode. If you missed anything, you can download it and listen. Find out all about that volcano in the Congo, and you can find out all about Eritrea in one episode. We don't mess around. CliffCentral.com